This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Rush Limbaugh recently called Sandra Fluke a slut on his nationally syndicated radio program. Sandra Fluke is a law student at Georgetown University and an activist for women's rights. She testified in Congress on the need for health insurance to cover contraception. After public outcry and several of his advertisers dropped the show, Rush Limbaugh offered an apology of sorts. Sandra Fluke rejected it. Sure, the language was ugly, but for many feminists, what's more troubling is the fact that contraception is still contested in some quarters. For these women, history is repeating itself, and not in a good way. The lesson is that eternal vigilance is indeed the price of hard-won freedoms. At UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, and countless other colleges across the country, there's an effort to give voice to the long and often untold story of the women's movement. It's particularly important in the South, where the record has received less attention. Today we'll consider the history of the women's movement in the South and what the historical record can tell us about today's news. Joining me in the studio to start off are Rachel Seidman, Associate Director of the Southern Oral History Program at UNC Chapel Hill. Joey Fink is a PhD student and in history at UNC Chapel Hill. And Laura Mickham is the Merle Hoffman Director of the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture. That is part of the David M. Rubenstein Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Duke. I want to welcome all of you to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Rachel, why is the history of the women's movement, why is that an urgent issue?
Well, I think that it's important for two different reasons, at least. First of all, it's important that the history that we teach and that we write and that we save is balanced. It's important because we get the past wrong if we don't include the perspectives and the experiences of women. So not only are we ignoring the experiences of half the population, but it's harder to understand why and how things happened the way they did if you don't take women into account. For instance, most of the great reform movements of our history, abolition of slavery, temperance, the progressive era labor reform movements, the civil rights movement, had women front and center, or in some cases more behind the scenes, and they brought their own concerns as women to those movements. So if we ignore that, it's almost impossible to understand why those movements unfolded the way they did. But beyond, it also goes beyond what we read in the history books. I think that this is really important for young people today, both girls and boys. I think it's really important for little girls and for young women's sense of themselves and their place in the world. If you never see women as agents of change or as important actors in the world, it's harder to imagine yourself as being of value and being of worth. It's harder to imagine what role you might play in the world. And it certainly affects the way boys and young men learn to think about women. So for all those reasons, I think that making sure women's history is part of the ongoing conversation and part of the story is deeply important.
And for those reasons and more, women's history has been taught, at least over the past several decades. Mm-hmm. But our sense is that it is largely a movement concentrated in the Northeast. Is that a fair assumption, at least about our perceptions?
The way that the story gets told is usually one that focuses on the Northeast. It's one that talks about the movement as happening in New York City or Boston for the most part. Now, that has been changing. Recently, we've had more attention being paid particularly to the Midwest. But what our work is trying to do now is say that this is also a very important movement in the South and that women experience this movement as being important to themselves in the South. And that really hasn't been told very much to this point.
You certainly have documentation at the Oral History Archive at UNC, and Laura Mickham, the Sally Bingham Center, also has a massive volume of documentation, and certainly contradicts this idea that there wasn't much going on down here in the South when it came to women's rights.
That's certainly the case, and in fact, the very existence of the Sally Bingham Center is in no small measure as a result of a desire on the part of a number of individuals to establish a broad-based major women's history archive in the Southeast, not just to intentionally create a collection of material documenting Southern women, including Southern activists, but also as a sort of alternative, if you will, and now one of the three major broad-based women's history archives in the country that documents women's history that's taken place all over the world, and including in...
Well, give us a little bit of its history. How did it get here? Who's Sally Bingham?
Sally Bingham was a member of the Kentucky Bingham family. Her family, prominent in the news media, particularly the Louisville Courier Journal. Sally herself, a writer and a journalist and a publisher. She was very interested in writing for the family newspaper, but was never given a meaningful role, and so upset the balance of power, and decided to go off and pursue many of her dreams. One of which was to enable a project in the South to document the history of women. And so in 1987, she and Anne Fire Scott, one of the most important living historians of women, encountered each other and hatched an idea to create a women's history archive. And within a year, the archive was established. So we are almost 25 years old.
Why at Duke?
Because Anne Fire Scott's career was almost entirely at Duke University, and that is where she was located when she and Sally Bingham first met. Sally has other connections to North Carolina, but it's in no small measure because of Anne Fire Scott.
So, Joey Fink, you're a graduate student in women's history at Carolina. What got you interested in the subject?
Well, I think Rachel's point about being able to see yourself in history and learn a history that's relevant to you is really key. When I was an undergrad, I was drawn to the history of working class people, to the history of the labor movement, because I'm from a working class family. But I didn't see people in these histories that looked like the women I knew growing up, like the women in my family, the women in my town. So it wasn't until I took a women's history course at UMass Boston that I was introduced to literature that spoke to me personally and demonstrated, you know, the strength of these women, what they were involved in doing, and the movements that they led. And I wanted to be a part of creating that and contributing to it.
And when you hear the stories of women, the idea that it is a history, when it becomes apparent that there's a history that they're a part of, that changes things. I want to bring in some of the voices of the women who are collected in
Please.
These archives.
Yes.
And I want to start with Wanda Sobieski. First, tell us a little bit about Wanda.
Okay. I interviewed Wanda Sobieski for part of the Southern Oral History Program's Long Women's Movement in the American South. She lives in Knoxville, Tennessee. She's a lawyer. She moved to Knoxville in the 70s and got involved with a group of women who were working to pass the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment. And she wasn't a lawyer at that point. She was a mother and was really drawn to the ERA because she felt it was important for her daughters to grow up and have equal rights under the Constitution. And this interview for me was a little bit of an eye-opener, even feeling maybe a little arrogant that, oh, I know women's history and I know the history of the women's movement. This interview opened up a new perspective on the ERA for me because I had thought of it as a legal battle that didn't relate to maybe my particular interest or the women I was interested in studying. And when she talks about it, it became so clear to me how important this battle really was and how devastating it was for the women involved when it didn't pass.
And in this clip, she will talk about what brought her to the women's movement.
I started, I guess, when I confronted the arguments of people like the Eagle Forum that made no sense to me. Why would giving me equal opportunity mean that it would destroy my home? Why would it do that? That doesn't make sense to me. How can it be controversial in a country that has founded itself on freedom and equality to give equality? How can that even be controversial, let alone the kind of firestorm we got when we tried to pass the Equal Rights Amendment? Couldn't understand it. And then somebody told me it had been the same with suffrage.
Rachel Seidman, when you hear that clip of tape, Wanda Sobieski talking about how she came of age and to her consciousness, what does that say to you?
Well, a couple of things. When she talks about, you know, she's questioning, why are people saying if I get equality, that's going to destroy my home? And that's such a long-running issue and problem in women's history. There's this fear that, you know, it's long been understood that there's been this kind of conception that women belong in the private sphere and take care of the home in the domestic arena, and men belong in the public sphere. And that's the way we've sort of described this. And it's never actually been true, for one thing. You know, many women, especially working class and black women, always were working and maintaining the home. So it's always been just a way of describing things that didn't really actually hold true. But it was very powerful. And for many women, you know, she references the Eagle Forum, and we know that Phyllis Schlafly was, you know, very active against the ERA. So this isn't actually men in many cases acting against the ERA. In some, many cases, it's women. And she and Wanda's kind of facing this backlash against it and trying to figure out what, you know, why are people arguing this?
Well, there's the intuition, number one, or the sense that this is an awakening. Why are people against this? And then, right. Joey, at the last moment, then she says, and it turns out it was the same for the suffrage movement. So then suddenly seeing herself as part of history is also interesting, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. And Wanda Sobieski is actually part of a group of women in Knoxville that were committed to getting a statue erected in downtown Knoxville to commemorate the passage of suffrage, sort of in an effort to inscribe into the landscape the history and the role Southern women have played in this history, and, you know, perhaps for themselves as a monument to their own work.
On the State of Things today, talking about the history of the women's movement in America, particularly in the South. My guests are Rachel Seidman, Laura Clark Brown will be with us in a moment, Joey Fink of UNC, and Laura Mickham of Duke. And after a short break, we will continue our conversation on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about the long history of the women's movement in America, particularly in the South. My guests are Rachel Seidman, Associate Director of the Southern Oral History Program at UNC Chapel Hill. Joey Fink is a PhD student in history at UNC Chapel Hill. Laura Mickham is the Merle Hoffman Director of the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture at Duke. And right now, I want to bring in Laura Clark Brown, Senior Librarian at the Southern Historical Collection at UNC Chapel Hill. Laura, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And we talked just a minute ago about the importance of not only sort of coming to consciousness about the essential inequalities, recognizing them, but then seeing yourself as part of a movement. Is that important? Why does that matter? Why is it important to know that what you're observing is actually part of a continuum?
Well, I have had the great pleasure of consulting with a class this semester called The Art of Persuasion, Southern Women's Rhetoric. And in that course, we have tried to have the students examine very closely women's texts from the archive. And it was challenging in many ways to find texts from about the around the antebellum period to the early 20th century because of the way the archive was in fact founded. And I just in terms of understanding the history, and as Rachel was saying earlier, understanding women as major historical actors, just as in studying history and watching students come to understand women as these important political players has been very eye-opening for me, and I think eye-opening for the students as well.
But it is a tricky business, isn't it, Laura Mickham, because you mentioned Anne Firewall Scott, whose treatises and work on women's history, particularly in the South, showed us that the way the record was written was guaranteed to keep women out. She had to go into diaries and letters because the official record didn't even recognize women. So finding these documents and knowing what to look for at something like the Sally Bingham Library is pretty darn important, right?
Right. I mean, it represents nothing less than a revolution in our profession, mine and Laura Clark Brown's, in that the way that our work came to pass, the way that it was done, was not about recognizing women. If women's materials came in as a part of the collections of their fathers or their husbands, why then we were lucky that they weren't thrown away, but they certainly weren't recognized in any descriptive inventory of those collections. And so, and if they were, sometimes they were trivialized or worse. And so part of the work of Women's History Archives, especially at a place like the Sally Bingham Center, which exists within the larger context of a broad-based special collections library, is to recover, to uncover the women's papers that have been there all along. So the Rubenstein Library has existed since the 1930s, the Bingham Center since the 1980s. So 5 decades of women's papers were uncovered by my predecessor. That's her first act as the director of the Bingham Center.
And Rachel, I think one of the things then that these documents reveal is the diversity among women's thoughts. I mean, we talked earlier about mm-hmm. Phyllis Schlafly and the mm-hmm. head of the Eagle Forum, an anti-feminist group, very powerful group back mm-hmm. in the 70s. If you were to discover or talk about a feminist movement or a women's movement and not reveal all of this, it would be a pretty lopsided view. We get a much broader view.
That's exactly right. And one of the things that is so powerful, I think, to young women these days is learning about that variety and that those debates that have happened over time, because that helps them understand the debates they see going around them today with putting that in a kind of historical context.
You know, we talked about the tape, and just before the break, we listened to Wanda Sobieski and her fight for the Equal Rights Amendment, Joey. And I'm going to play another clip because women had become engaged in political movements and to their frustration, particularly when it came to the Equal Rights Amendment. And here's Wanda Sobieski talking about what happened when the effort to pass the ERA failed.
I don't know that I ever felt as strongly about anything as I did that it needed to pass. I had a little girl born in 1974, and it was just very important to me that she have equal rights when she turned 18. But when it failed, and it became pretty obvious that it was likely to, and that's about the time I went to law school, it just knocked the wind out of all of us. Some of the people that I worked with every day just disappeared. They wouldn't return phone calls. It was hard to get to see them. They were depressed. A lot of the women went sort of privatized, went back to their own little, you know, world that they could control, which is, you know, a way of coping with that kind of loss.
Joey, it was interesting to me to hear that your sense of the ERA was one of these sort of failed legal efforts, but, you know, there it goes. And if you had read in a history book that many women became discouraged after the failure of the ERA, it would have been that. But something changed in you in hearing that story mm-hmm. and in meeting Wanda.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I mean, that's the value of oral history, is that it can bring new voices into the historical record. It can also tell us something new about topics we're familiar with. These women weren't just discouraged. They were depressed, and it changed their ideas of perhaps, you know, what it was possible to do or to change. Wanda said just after that excerpt, she followed it up by saying, "It was hard to look at people quite the same way after that. You look at voters and you want to say, why is it that you don't think that 51 or 53% or whatever it is of the people in this country ought to have equal opportunity? What is so bad about us?" So this story she tells from her personal perspective then opens up this whole new window into the emotional dimensions of political work.
Let's talk more about that. Laura Scott Brown, is that common in the record that you've, as you go through the record, this sense of real loss, of a kind of depression in these political battles? Does it come up in any of the record or, you know, in previous battles? Certainly the suffrage movement was something that went on for quite a while. There were wins and there were losses. And you wonder if sort of knowing about the emotional consequences of engagement, again, expands the understanding of this, what was going on. It's not just men against the women. There's a powerful, complex, textured history here.
Absolutely. And women, I think, were anxious to participate early on. If I could share a portion of a letter written in 1932 under the letterhead of the National Committee on the Federal Legislation for Birth Control, a woman named Mrs. H. Grady Moore writes to Frank Porter Graham, the president of the University of North Carolina and a leading progressive in the South. She writes, "Since leaving North Carolina, I've been doing welfare work in Virginia, and I realized more than ever that the feeding of people was not helping them very much when we were doing nothing about assisting them to limit their families for physical, mental, or economic reasons." And she goes on to ask Frank Porter Graham to help in advocating for an amendment to federal laws that prohibited the dissemination of supplies and even information on birth control. And so you see her activism began with welfare and quickly turned to a women's rights issue. And this was in 1932.
Laura Mickum, do we get a sense of the success of women in the political sphere when we look at some of the records that were not part of the official record? In other words, there were successes that should be attributed to women that haven't been, and that's, I think, part of the record, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think the point of a women's history archive is that it's not just small sound bites or something that is sort of flashy and appealing to mainstream media, but it is the process of the work, the wins, the losses, the journey that is towards social justice. I also think that something unique to the women's movement that's different from other social justice movements is that many of the achievements of the women's movement are not attributed to the women's movement, and that a place like the Sally Bingham Center or the Sophia Smith Collection at Smith College or the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe can reveal all of the accomplishments of that movement and tie them very, very, very clearly to those women and those actions.
So there are accomplishments that the movement perhaps should be credited for, but then again, there are women in the movement who don't always consider themselves feminist. And Joey, you spoke with a woman in Kentucky who described the making of grassroots feminism. Let's listen to her.
While we were putting together in Praise the Mountain Women, and that was kind of, in conversations, it was kind of a unified aha, you know, that a lot of us had come to about, wait a minute. I mean, we would sit for hours and have these conversations about, why is it this way? And you would have one piece, and I would have one piece, and she would have another piece, and she would have another piece, and we would just build on all that, you know, we would go, wow, you know. And maybe I am a feminist, because, you know what, really, let's define what feminism is for us, what it means to us, what that would mean here, and that's kind of grassroots feminism kind of got born out of those kinds of conversations.
And was that a difficult label to bear in the South, a particularly difficult label to bear, feminism?
I think that some women found it to be too narrow for what they felt like they were doing. What I often heard in interviews, and I should add that my colleague Jesse Wilkerson did that particular interview we just listened to, is I heard women say, I was for women's rights, but I was also, or conversely, I needed to do this for my family, for my community, for my coworkers, and it was a women's issue at the heart of it. So that's why I think this project that we're doing is not only turning the attention to the South and telling the story of the women's movement in the South, but also asking us to reconsider what feminism means and indeed how we even understand it. You know, how have we learned what a feminist is?
Well, I think that's a very important point, because how we frame the debate becomes an important question in the sort of outcomes we get. And the whole Rush Limbaugh fiasco, you know, he's saying, well, it's all about whether or not an insurance company should be required to. It's not. I mean, he used the term slut. He was denigrating women, and he pitted women against men. This was a power equation that was brought to bear on what he then calls a social policy question. So the fact that we can't talk about it squarely because it becomes so obscured in these other issues, Rachel, that's part of the problem, isn't it, how we frame the debate?
Well, exactly. And I mean, we have decades of centuries of evidence that women have been actually, as Laura's letter from 1932 shows, I mean, women have been fighting for the right for birth control and to control their families because it relates to their health, because it relates to their ability to feed their families, because it relates to their ability to live full lives. It is not not about just wanting to have as much sex as possible, you know, the way Rush wants to form it. So this is, you know, I think that when young women are not kind of taught the history of these long battles, when they simply kind of take birth control for granted and don't realize the fight that it took in order for them to have access to that, they are slower to recognize the attack that's being made on them, and slower to recognize what's at stake. And that, like you were saying before, things can get taken away. We don't always move in a forward direction, and that it's going to take activism and education and speaking out on their part to protect these rights that their forebears have gained for them.
Things can be taken away because the resistance has never ended, and I think
right.
that's one of the disguises that you know, that cloaks a victory, because you have a sense now we've won, and so that issue is put to rest.
Mm-hmm.
But what is it? Let's talk about some of the deeper issues. Rush Limbaugh has lost a few sponsors, but he's gained many listeners. His listenership has never been higher. And that raises the question, what is it that he's appealing to? He's accessing some kind of anxiety, a latent anxiety, as we've just suggested, doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
Men certainly benefit as much by contraception as women, so they don't want contraception to go away, but they do want this division and this hierarchy to remain intact. What's going on there? Why? What's the appeal of his message? To whom is he appealing?
Well, I think one of our interviews that we collected with a working class woman in Knoxville, Marion Groover, she used Title VII legislation to push into better paying male-dominated factory work in the steel industry, and went to work for the Alcoa plant.
And about when was that?
This would have been in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
She got involved with her union. She was she eventually got involved with the education committee that the union ran. But she was sort of admonished by her union rep for wearing a button on her jacket that said, "This is what a radical feminist looks like." He suggested that, you know, you're going to scare away some people who you might otherwise be able to talk to about union representation. And she said she would just come back when she would be faced with resistance on the shop floor in the union hall. She would come back with a statement, "Well, you know, did your wife work? Did your mother work? Don't you want your daughter to be able to work? Do you want your daughter to be able to vote and be self-reliant?" And that sort of brought it home to them in a way that they had to confront that, in a way that when it's an abstract issue or a legislative issue, you can push that away and say, you know, that's not what's really at stake.
How has it come to be, or are we framing women's issues too narrowly? Why aren't they recognized as workers' rights issues, health issues, education issues? How has that come to be, Rachel?
Well, I think that is a really great question, and one that people have been talking about a lot, both scholars and activists, and talking about how in some cases we do need to reframe some of these questions. That, for instance, work-life balance debate has always been framed as one that really applies only to women. And, of course, that's absolutely not true. Getting men to understand their stake in these issues and connecting with those who already see themselves as allies, but then opening up conversations with people with, for instance, labor unions about how we structure work and what that means for our ability to care for our families. These are issues that appeal or apply to both men and women, and I think that people are beginning to understand that more and work harder to make those conversations happen.
But here's the difficult question. If that's true and we want to open the frame to look at a broader context to understand these issues, do women's studies programs, do women's oral history collections, are they barriers in a sense? Do they keep reminding us that it's women's issues and women's rights that we're talking about?
Well, I think no, I don't think that they're barriers, and I think they're absolutely essential. I think that they are starting to open up these conversations in new ways. And one of the things I was going to sort of go back to, we were talking about how these oral interviews kind of uncover some women who maybe at first didn't see themselves as part of the women's movement. But we also uncover women who were not part of what we would call the women's movement, but who very much understand gender as playing a role in what they did. And so we have, for instance, an interview with an activist in the civil rights movement from Montgomery who talks about she doesn't call it the civil rights movement. She calls it the Southern Freedom Movement. She says because it was not only a movement for civil rights, it was also a movement for human dignity. I think when you limit it to civil rights, she says, you obscure, first of all, the horrors of segregation. You do not have to come to terms with the violence. You do not have to come to terms with the economic oppression. You do not have to come to terms with the fact that no black girl was safe from rape in that society. You obscure all of that. And she says, another point I want to make about that is that when we look at Rosa Parks, people often think that she did that because of her civil rights and wanting to sit down on the bus. But she also did that. It was a rebellion of maids, a rebellion of working class women who were tired of boarding the buses in Montgomery, the public space, and being assaulted and called out of their names and abused by white bus drivers. And that's why that movement could hold so long. If it had just been merely a protest about riding the bus, it might have shattered. But it went to the very heart of black womanhood, and black women played a major role in sustaining that movement. And so that's why I think it's really important to see the larger context.
On the State of Things today, talking about the long women's movement and its history, particularly in the South, it's a conversation that will continue after a short break. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today about the history of the women's movement in America, particularly in the South. What can the historical record teach us about activism today and the struggle for equality? My guests are Rachel Seidman, Associate Director of the Southern Oral History Program at UNC Chapel Hill. Joey Fink is a PhD student at Carolina. Laura Mickham is the Merle Hoffman Director of the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture at Duke. And Laura Clark Brown is a Senior Librarian at the Southern Historical Collection at UNC Chapel Hill. So before the break, we're talking about sort of enlarging and changing the frame of the discussion, and it leads to another question about representation, women's representation. We're seeing fewer and fewer women these days, in the last couple of years, represented in political circles. Maybe my first question is Rachel, what do you think accounts for that?
That's a really complicated question. I mean, just a few years ago when Hillary Clinton was running on the national stage and we had Sarah Palin running for vice president, there was this moment at which it seemed like maybe this story was really changing. But you're right that overall the numbers have been going down. And, I mean, there's been for centuries, there's been a kind of debate among women over whether they need to seek representation because they are equal to and the same as men or because they are different than men. And this has caused splits among women over what is the right way to go about seeking representation. Why do we say we ought to be represented equally? Is it because we bring a different perspective, a special perspective, or is it just because we are naturally half of the human race and therefore ought to, have the same? So that's been an ongoing debate and one that I think still causes rifts among women.
Laura Mickham, I wonder how that's represented in the record as women talk about whether or not we should be in the public sphere because we're the same or because we're fundamentally different. We bring something else to the picture.
Well, I think a powerful example of that in the collections at Duke are the papers of Elna Spaulding and the organization she created in Durham, North Carolina, Women in Action for the Prevention of Violence and Its Causes, which doesn't sound like a collection that has much to do with electoral politics. But in fact, the work that she was doing, which was some of the first work in this area that brought together black women and white women, was specifically to educate women as to how to overcome school desegregation and other about racial violence so that they could have live full lives, as Rachel said, so that they could make sure that their children had all of the opportunities that were available to the most privileged children. And she was able to bring together women, a huge diversity of women in this area around that cause. And many of those women did go on to being interested in elected office and political representation. But they came from many, many different perspectives.
But it suggests, though, that what you're addressing is the historical imbalance. In other words, if we're not being treated the same way in schools, if we're not given the same opportunities, then we're going to have a separate forum to address the imbalance so we can educate ourselves, come up to speed, and then move forward in the political sphere. So the question then remains, if you've addressed those, as we reach equilibrium, if we have or if we're on the way, do you need those? Does there have to be that kind of special forum for women, a special platform in order to engage the system?
Well, I think, well, what Rachel and Laura were saying, you know, it also brings to mind the point that women are also, they also, you know, are of a socioeconomic class. They have a racial identity, an ethnic identity. And, you know, you look at who represents Americans in the corridors of power, it's not poor people getting up into the office. It's not working class, but usually, you know, so there is a question of what people think it's possible to do with their lives. And I think women have these sort of multiple layers to get through to that. You know, first, do I have access to education and do I have people encouraging me to do this? And as a woman, you know, do I need to plan my family life and my marriage possibilities around this? And this comes out in some of the interviews. Actually, it reminded me of an interview not so much about politics but about sports, where I did an interview with a woman who is her parents filed a lawsuit on her behalf to end half-court basketball in Tennessee. She was from Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And she talks about –
that's a particular set of rules that governed women's basketball in only a couple of states.
Yes,
and
yes.
It does limit their possibilities for going on.
Exactly,
after high school.
Exactly. Yeah. That she wouldn't be able to compete for scholarships as well as others. And she talks about having to share a uniform with – when she was on the track team, she had to share a uniform with a girl on the basketball team and vice versa. And she says, you know, very poignantly that it was just a visual – a very visible way where I could see that they were saying to me, you don't matter as much. And I think that would be true in the political realm too.
And the other way you see it is in the virulence of the resistance to women becoming empowered. And we'll go back to the activist in Kentucky that you talked with as she talks about what it took and what she endured as she became active.
There were factions of the community when I lived over there that thought I was, one, a witch. Had to be a witch. Two, a communist. Three, probably a lesbian. Because those were the only kind of people who would have the kind of notions I had and would act on them. You had to be a lesbian, a communist, or a witch, or maybe a combination of.
So is history repeating itself?
Yeah, it sounds very familiar today after Russia's attacks. I mean, I think one of the things that's been so powerful for me is when we teach the actual story, when we talk about these stories with young women today, and we talk about people, older, married, working class women from Kentucky doing, you know, this kind of activism. We talk about poor black women and their activism. We talk about women who were fighting for the, you know, the right for to be able to play sports, to have the kind of jobs they wanted to have, to be have access to education. My students, even today, kind of look up halfway through the semester with this look of amazement on their face. I just didn't know, right? I really honestly thought that feminists were bra burners and man haters. And that's the story that I've been told my entire life. And I had no idea about what had really happened. And they get to this point of sort of amazement and anger. They say to me, why did no one ever teach me this in high school? Why did I not know? And it's both infuriating and empowering to them. So just recently, I sort of stopped halfway through a semester in the course that I'm teaching at Duke on women in the public sphere, history, theory, and practice. And we put up on the board, I asked them to think about all of the different strategies that women had used to gain change, to make change over the what had they read about? And, you know, they were calling out to me and I was writing up on the blackboard, picketing, striking, humor, street theater, you know, boycotts, door-to-door education. We filled two blackboards with all these different strategies for all this different kind of social change. And there was just this moment where the students sort of sat back and looked at these blackboards and went, oh, my goodness. You know, I had no idea. And now in that class, the students are they're trying to come up with a final project, and they've decided that they need to do a media campaign on campus about feminism, what it is, what it's for, what it's not. And, you know, to me as a teacher, it's inspiring. It's wonderful. It's terrific that they want to do this. But I'm also very conscious of the fact that it's because women's history is not part of the regular conversation. It's because of the warped stories that have been told about the feminist movement that they feel the need to do this. We are telling these same stories over and over again, and we have to keep teaching them to young women because they don't learn them in elementary school and in high school.
And as important as it is to teach these lessons, to make sure the history is well known, to be able to see your face among the people who've actually promoted and were successful at making change, one of the things it seems to me that every rights movement has done is reflected its opponent. And the opponent, while the victims have been different, they may have been women, they may have been African Americans, they may have been immigrants, they may have been children, but the opponent is always the same. It's a vanishingly a small number of people who have an enormous amount of power and who would love to keep these people at each other's throats. And I wonder to what extent you think that this movement, the women's movement, does reflect just that. In other words, this common opponent, where power resides and how ferociously it hangs on.
Well, I think it definitely comes up in Marion Groover's interview, because, you know, she's pushing into a space, she's claiming a job that is coveted. It's well paying. It's got good benefits.
This our Alcoa worker?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Yes, yes. Yeah. And so she's threatening. She's not intending to threaten these men. She wants to work with them, but she's perceived as a threat and has to, you know, either prove herself or reason herself into their world. And it's not because these men are puppets on a string of an invisible hand. It's not because they're dupes. It's not because they're bad men. It's because they have stakes in this too. And they're not being taught through school, through popular education, through their interactions, to think of their stakes as the same as this woman who's claiming a job.
Right.
In their
they have very little control over their – Alcoa is a major corporation, international corporation, who controls their lives. They tell them how many days off you can have, how many sick days, and whether or not you will work. There's an unemployment rate of X percent, and you could be there. So that's the anxiety you're faced with, little or no control over your workplace. And then along comes this woman who is there by some kind of affirmative action program, mm-hmm. right? Now you've really set up a dynamic. And so the whole big question of workers' rights is off the table, because it's whether or not she should have been there or whether another man was more qualified.
And this also speaks to your question about, you know, affecting change through getting more women in representative offices. But, you know, this is a question of how change happens. Does it trickle down from legislative victories? Does it trickle down from people in power? Or does it happen one-on-one? Because Marion did affect some serious change. She changed the way people thought. She became, you know, she became a leader in her union. So she made change work where she was, and she didn't do it from D.C.
Right, but she did become a leader. She became a union leader. So, Laura Clark Brown, I wonder how these kinds of conflicts are reflected in the record at the Southern Historical Collection. Women sort of debating among themselves what their role should be and whether or not they would, you know, the perception of women stepping out of their role would somehow be more damaging. How are these debates reflected?
Well, I think that women have wanted, as evidenced in the historical record, have wanted to be participants in the political discourse, in the public sphere, and they have been. They took advantage of every opportunity they could to be in that political discourse. And we see a lot of women participating in the some of the movements that we've already discussed or were mentioned, such as abolitionism. And then later we see a lot of evidence of women using clubs, women's clubs and associations, particularly in the early 20th century. But then getting involved in what are traditionally considered civil rights causes and being very active in those as well. And I think that was the best means for these women to be able to participate, especially in the South, is through these clubs and these other organizations.
Yeah, Laura Mickham, certainly Ann Firewire Scott's work has demonstrated the power of these social organizations that were dismissed by men, but quite powerful and effective in their time.
Absolutely. And in fact, at their beginning, not even allowed to exist. So it was revolutionary for women to come together in a secular gathering or a non-family gathering. So they had a sort of danger about them even from the beginning, that women would come together in the absence of men to do something that had nothing to do with religion or family. And out of these clubs came some of the most important social movements, like Hull House in Chicago. That in U.S. history.
Well, and the idea that we would review and rethink what we consider family, that a woman's role is not what you men have told us it is, but our families are much broader and more complex than that. It comes up in other ways in your archive, Laura Mickham. I know there's quite a bit about lesbian life in America, and you say there's a connection that you can draw between the fight for reproductive rights and AIDS.
It's a very moving connection to me. It turns out that many of the activists in the 1960s and early 1970s, pre-Roe v. Wade, on behalf of safe and legal abortion, were lesbian women who saw women around them die of illegal abortions, and some of them, of course, succumbed as well. And then some of these very same women worked in the 1980s around the AIDS crisis and saw many men around them and some of their own die of AIDS. And so there's a population of lesbian women, and you can trace this in our collections at Duke, who are the living memory of both of those struggles, literally those struggles between life and death.
So, Rachel Seidman, is this a cycle in American politics where women in particular will sort of be able to, you know, work above ground out in the open, and then there are these periods where all the work has to be kind of underground and wait for that moment of clarity and openness?
You know, it's a really interesting question. I mean, one of the things that I think our oral histories have shown, there's a narrative in women's history that says that after the suffrage movement, we entered into kind of the doldrums where nothing happened until the 1960s. And one of the things that our oral histories have really demonstrated is that that's just not true, that we may not have recognized what was happening. We may not have noticed what was happening. But women were fighting for equal rights during this entire period, whether they were in the YWCA or in other organizations that were fighting for rights for African Americans, but also for women at the same time. And so even though we kind of think of these quiet moments, usually if you dig into the archives, if you talk to people, you find out that this never really goes away.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for having us.
Rachel Seidman is Associate Director of the Southern Oral History Program at UNC Chapel Hill. Joey Fink is a PhD student of history at Carolina. Laura Mickham is the Merle Hoffman Director of the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture, part of the David M. Rubenstein Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Duke. And Laura Clark Brown is Senior Librarian at the Southern Historical Collection at UNC Chapel Hill. Thanks for listening to The State of Things Today. It is a program that comes to you from North Carolina Public Radio, which is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.